for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch dominate the U.S. credit rating industry. Local governments and many institutions cannot purchase bonds and other investments without a high rating from one of the Securities and Exchange Commission-approved agencies. But those agencies are widely blamed for failing to accurately rate investments tied to subprime mortgages and setting off the near collapse of the U.S. economy. A House committee has begun to examine the ratings industry and the dangers that investors still face. Joining me in the studio to talk about the controversy over credit ratings agencies, Alex Pollack of the American Enterprise Institute and Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine. Joining us by phone from the University of San Diego is Frank Partnoy. And we will be taking your calls throughout the hour. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First, as we begin, we're going to spend a few moments with Congressman Ed Towns. He's chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, and there were hearings held before his committee yesterday. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. What did you learn yesterday from the two whistleblowers? Why did you convene this hearing?
Well, I convened the hearing because AIG and Lehman were rated AAA. And, of course, we know what happened with them. And then we look further to find out that these rating agencies structured a deal, and not only do they structure the deal, then they also rate the deal. And so we were saying that's a conflict of interest, and that's the reason why we felt that AIG had problems and Lehman had problems, and people were not aware of these problems because of this whole conflict of interest.
So tell us what you heard in the testimony from the two whistleblowers, Mr. Kolchinsky and Mr. McCreskey.
Right. Basically, they said that these whistleblowers, that there was no real interest in terms of the agencies to the rating agencies to correct this whole problem that was going on, that they felt very comfortable doing it the way they were doing it. And when they complained about it, that's when they pushed them out. So the fact that they indicated that, you know, we are not doing this accurately, we're misleading people, and that at that point, you know, they found reasons to say you no longer work here. And so we felt that looking into it was very, very important. And then the other thing was that after he filed a complaint, then Kramer Levin, a law firm, said they asked him to come and look at it. And, of course, we said, oh, that's great. Kramer Levin is going to look at this, so we'll be able to get their records to see in terms of what really transpired. But what they said was it was an oral request and for them to do certain things. And the response back to us was oral, that there's no paper trail, that we do not believe in paper. And I just could not believe a law firm did not believe in a trail. I mean, I just could not understand that at all. So, and then when we had people like Al D'Amato, who indicated that we need more regulations because of the fact that the confidence of the American people was diminishing, and that if we did not do something about that, that people would not continue to invest. And, of course, he indicated that, you know, we're looking at the meltdown. We need to make certain that anybody that had anything to do with our financial system, we should make certain that they clean it up so people would have that reassurance that they make an investment that, of course, that was a safe thing to do.
And Congressman Towns, at the end of the hearing, you said the testimony we heard today is just the opening chapter of what promises to be a sordid story. We intend to pursue this further. What more can you do? What will the Securities and Exchange Commission do?
Well, first of all, I think that we need to make certain that we get additional testimony from the rating agencies, because we had a gentleman by the name of Richard Cantor who knew nothing, didn't see anything, hadn't heard any. And, of course, I finally wanted to know what was he doing there, because evidently he had no idea. So they just sort of, I think, sent him because of the fact that there was a threat that we might subpoena. So the point is that I really feel that we have to talk to the SEC and to get in terms of their input and to see what we need to do in order to make certain that we strengthen our system. We have this meltdown, and that in order to reassure the American people and to get them investing again, we have to make certain that this system is clean. And that's what we're trying to do as much as possible. So we'll be looking and hope to be able to talk to other people in Moody's, because Mr. Cantor just could not answer our questions.
Now, Congressman Towns, these are all nationally recognized rating organizations, or NRSOs. Now, the question becomes, why should anybody trust any of them now?
I think that's an excellent question, and that's what we're trying to do, is to clean it up where people will have confidence in it, that will not see them structure the deal and then come back and rate the deal that they structured.
Okay, but how do you restructure this whole process?
Well, we also have to look at the way they're paid. You see, if I am paid by you, then I will do basically what you want me to do. So I think we have to look at the way they're being paid, because if they're going to get a check from the structuring it, they're going to get a check for rating it, you know, from the company that's asking for this information. So we need to look at the paying. I think that we have to find a way to structure it so they're not caught up in the paying and the structuring and all that. And we're not sure as to how we do this. We want to talk to the SEC, we want to talk to others. And this is what this is all about. But the present structure is just not something that is very, very reliable or trustworthy.
But, you know, this all happened more than a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just getting around to looking at these credit ratings agencies. How long is it going to take before you get some restructuring involved?
Well, we're hoping that we finish our get information collecting real soon and get it over to financial services, and that financial services then will take this information and restructure the system. Because, as you know, this meltdown is something that everybody now is concerned about, and there's a lot of people that played a part in this. And we need to make certain that we talk to as many people as we possibly can to make certain that when we move forward, that we move forward with a program that people can trust and feel comfortable with, because that is what this is really all about.
Congressman Ed Towns, he's chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. Thank you so much joining us. And now, turning to you, Michael Hirsch, you were at the hearings. Tell us precisely what the whistleblowers had to say.
Well, Eric Kolchinsky, the former senior managing director of Moody's Derivatives Group, was really the star witness. In fact, one of the things Congressman Towns didn't say was that he had had Kolchinsky down here in Washington a week ago, along with the other witnesses, and they were waiting for Moody's to respond, and they actually had them at the table and said, okay, we're postponing a week, and we're going to give Moody's another week to respond to this. So there was a sort of a dramatic buildup here, and what Kolchinsky said, I think, that was most striking was that, as you alluded to, well into this crisis, well into this year, after you would think these firms that had been responsible for hundreds of billions of dollars of losses and the most, you know, the biggest disaster since the Great Depression, they were still following the same practices, according to Kolchinsky. And I've checked out his testimony. I've talked to other Moody's officials who will vouch for his credibility. So I think that was the perhaps the most dramatic thing, that that even now the firms don't seem to be reforming their behavior.
Well, it sounds as though you had Kolchinsky calling out these conflicts of interest, these misleading ratings, and yet he gets fired in the process.
Right, and as Congressman Towns pointed out, there was a legal investigation by a firm that Moody's hired, but no written report. Moody's says that Kolchinsky resisted cooperating with the inquiry, which Kolchinsky denies. So, you know, to some extent you have a he said, she said situation, except for the fact that there does seem to be others corroborating what Kolchinsky has said. And you have this question of can these dominant firms that in effect have a government imprimatur because they are officially anointed as, you know, the recognized
the
agencies.
The ratings agencies.
And which no one can really probe into their methodologies of rating because they're extremely complex. So they, you know, they effectively have not had up until now a hearing like this, the one yesterday, any real accountability. And we're going to see going forward whether that changes.
Michael Hirsch, he's senior editor and national economics correspondent at Newsweek magazine and author of At War with Ourselves. When we come back, you'll hear from Alex Pollack at the American Enterprise Institute and Frank Partnoy. He's law and finance professor at the University of San Diego, author of The Match King. Short break, right back. And we're talking about the credit rating industry. This morning, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Frank Partnoy, talk about how the credit rating agencies themselves are currently regulated.
Right now, there's an elaborate web of regulation that forces investors to look to these credit rating agencies. So there are rules spread throughout the financial system like a virus that say, for example, if you're a money market fund, you can only buy bonds that are rated AAA or AA, the top two categories by the rating agencies. And these kinds of rules are everywhere in the financial system. And as a result, investors have decided to rely on ratings. And this virus has spread throughout the financial system. And the result is that we can hear about all of these problems like we heard about yesterday. The rating agencies can issue AAA ratings that are not even close to accurate and not be punished by the markets for them because effectively the government has said you have to use these ratings. It's an incredibly dysfunctional system.
Now, here's a question from Joseph in Barnegat, New Jersey, who says, are credit rating firms legally required to be accurate, or is the rating just their opinion, not subject to legal scrutiny? Alex Pollack.
I have to remember the main point is, of course, that ratings are about the future. And about the future, you can only have opinions. So you can't require someone to be accurate when it comes to the future, and there aren't legal requirements because such things are impossible.
But there now, is... hold on one second. If I'm buying a triple A rated bond now, that's not about the future.
Yes.
That's about now.
No, the triple A rating is about the future. And I think I'd have here to disagree with what the congressman said a minute ago. He said, if you're buying an investment, of course, we want you to feel safe. My opinion is the opposite. If you are buying any investment, you are, of course, at risk. And we want you to know that and be able to make some kind of judgment. So as Frank said, when you have the government, which basically created the oligopoly of credit rating agencies, and this discussion goes back at least 5 years. I testified first on the problem of the credit rating agencies in 2004. Wrote a little piece called End the Government-Sponsored Cartel and Credit Ratings at that time. And then we got a reform act, the Credit Rating Agency Reform Act of 2006, which I think was going quite a bit in the right direction. And now we see, I think, just as Frank suggested, that creating this special government privilege and indeed requirement to use the ratings was a big mistake.
So you'd like to see the government, as you call it, the government-sponsored cartel, come to an end.
Absolutely.
And how do you feel about that, Frank Partnoy?
Well, I think that's an important first step. But the one area where Alex and I would disagree is that, and I think a lot of people are angry about this, is that the rating agencies should be subject to liability just like any other actors in the financial markets. And it's right to say that part of what the financial markets are doing is a prediction about the future. But if you're reckless about your rating, if you're defrauding investors, you are liable generally. If you're an investment bank, if you're an accounting firm, if you're a law firm, if you're a company selling securities to people who are listening to this program right now, they can sue you. But the big difference with the credit rating agencies is you cannot sue them. They have been immune from liability until very recently. There are explicit statutory rules that the SEC has adopted a rule that says you can sue anyone else involved in the securities issuance process, but you cannot sue the credit rating agencies. And that's starting to change, but we're not talking about special rules for the credit rating agencies. We're talking about holding them to the same kinds of standards anyone else would be held to, which is you cannot defraud someone, you cannot be reckless in issuing these ratings.
And joining us now by phone from New York is Floyd Abrams. He's an attorney representing Standard & Poor's, one of the top credit ratings agencies. Good morning, sir. It's good to have you with us.
Good morning. It's good to be back on your air.
You make a First Amendment argument against holding rating agencies liable for their ratings. Explain that argument.
Well, first, we make that argument sometimes, but not in the sort of cases that Professor Partnoy is referring to. Fraud, for example, in fraud cases, there is no First Amendment defense, and there's no First Amendment defense with respect to the federal anti-fraud statute, the 1934 law passed by Congress. There are cases, though, in which people sue for negligence. And they say, you know, in effect, we can't prove you did anything wrong on purpose. We can't prove that you didn't believe in the ratings. We just don't think you did a very good job in putting the ratings together. And in cases like that, we do take the position that, as Mr. Pollack said, the rating is by its nature an opinion as to the future, and that we don't allow lawsuits, actually, even without the First Amendment, but certainly with it, about opinions. We don't allow lawsuits. We don't sustain lawsuits when people say, "You said that you thought that this stock would go up, and it didn't go up," or "You said that you thought that there's a high, very high likelihood that this company will pay back the debt it has in the future." And so, yes, in those situations, we do make a First Amendment argument. Now, what Congress is considering is not that sort of situation. What Congress is considering is whether to amend this very old 1934 law. And on that, our position is really that they should treat rating agencies like everyone else and no different from anyone else, that they should be liable if they do something knowing that it's not true or say something that they know isn't true or that they're acting recklessly as defined by the various cases in this area. So that's where we are right now on that.
Floyd Abrams, he's an attorney representing Standard & Poor's. Here's the other question from Joseph in Barnegat, New Jersey. Does this single massive failure of credit rating firms destroy their reason for being? Frank Partnoy.
Well, I'm not sure it destroys their reason for being. We always want to look out to intermediaries to give us some guidance about how to decide what to buy. And this started really back after the last big financial crisis in 1929, when governments and investors were trying to decide which bonds are good, which bonds are bad, who should we look to? And they started to look to credit rating agencies. And over time, people have relied more and more on the credit rating agencies. But if we had an open market, there would be competition. It wouldn't just be Standard & Poor's and Moody's and Fitch dominating this industry. And I just want to say briefly, your listeners heard something extraordinary from Floyd Abrams, who we know well and everyone respects as perhaps the leading First Amendment lawyer in the country. But this expression of his views is an extraordinary shift in S&P's position. They have argued vehemently that their ratings are protected by free speech, by the First Amendment, in cases that include fraud cases. And in fact, as recently as just a few months ago, had tried to defend themselves on these grounds. But they're starting to lose that argument, and people are starting to see that they're not the same as the Diane Rehm show. You're not getting compensated by the people appearing on your show for the opinions that you express. You're not involved in orchestrating what we're going to say in advance. And I think people are very skeptical of the rating agency's free speech argument. Mm. And so we just heard something extraordinary in his shift in view.
Michael Hirsch.
Just to expand on Professor Partnoy's point, these ratings used to be known in legal circles as the world's shortest editorial. That was the way they defended them in court. But on September 2nd, there was a striking ruling in New York District Court. Judge Scheinlin ruled in one lawsuit that because some of the ratings of Moody's and S&P were dedicated to a select group of investors, in other words, it's all part of this idea of how you do structured finance, it's not available to the general public, that they could not mount the traditional First Amendment defense. And a number of people have really noticed that and said perhaps this is the first crack in the wall.
Floyd Abrams.
Yeah, thank you. That is my case. We don't win them all, notwithstanding what some people say. What's happening here is not a change of position. The position that the federal anti-fraud laws govern the rating agencies like everyone else is a position of long standing. We have argued in cases like this one in New York, a very complicated case, where the party suing an Abu Dhabi bank has made 11 separate claims in that case. One of our defenses in general was a First Amendment defense. The court said 10 of the 11 claims I'm going to dismiss right now for one legal reason or another. And that just leaves the fraud claim. Mm. And then the court addressed the fraud claim. But the reality is there is, and indeed this same judge said, that as a general matter, the opinions of rating agencies expressed in the form of a rating are protected by the First Amendment. That in this particular case, because of the facts claimed by the plaintiff at this very early stage in the case, that she would allow the case to proceed. Down the road, we'll have another shot at this issue. I think the ruling against us, and it was against us on this one issue, has been significantly exaggerated in its import. But it certainly is an answer to people who say that there's just total immunity for rating agencies. There isn't. I'm working on over 30 cases right now brought against rating agencies, and while we hope we win them all, there's no guarantee of that. And the notion of Congress now thinking that it has to step in right now to impose new liability, brand new standards, and apply them only to rating agencies does not seem to me justified or appropriate or even fair.
Alex Pollack won the whistleblowers yesterday. Scott McCreskey wrote to the SEC with allegations of wrongdoing by Moody's. What did the SEC do about it?
I don't really know the answer to that, but if I could...
Does anyone?
I presume inside the SEC they know.
I gather the SEC has said they won't talk to the press about this, Michael.
Yes. They claim to be investigating and making various rule changes, but, it was very striking in the case of the other whistleblower, Eric Kolchinsky, that they didn't make contact with him until after he had gone public with his allegation.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, and Mr. Kolchinsky told the committee yesterday that the ratings agencies had lost their ability to say no. What did he mean?
What he meant was that, and Moody's is a striking case because they were considered actually the class act in this industry for a long time. When it was a question of rating straightforwardly corporate or municipal bonds and the ratings could be checked against performance, they generally performed well for a long time. What happened during this whole era of very complex derivatives and structured finance, which is sort of private derivatives deals, securitized assets deals between companies, particularly as all of these different assets like mortgages got bundled up and then, sliced and diced, it became enormously difficult to check the accuracy of the ratings, as we found out when they all went bad at once 2 years ago. And what happened was because the different agencies have different methodologies, it became difficult to check their accuracy. And so they lost any sense of accountability. This is basically what Kolchinsky was saying. And so the temptation of these huge fees that they were paid by the issuers, by the underwriters, the investment banks, became great. And there was no sort of countervailing weight where, they would have had a fear of exposure of bad ratings any longer.
And these whistleblowers were actually replaced. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, Kolchinsky was in a very senior position at Moody's. And when he began to raise concerns, I believe it was September 2007, according to the memos that he made available to the committee, he was basically fired from his position.
Frank Partnoy, when you were a derivatives trader at Morgan Stanley, you've said you manipulated the agencies. How did you do that?
Well, everyone in the business did that and has been doing it. And one of the remarkable things about Kolchinsky's letters is that they continue to do it. And he's talking about conduct from this year. And basically the way that it's done is that you grab a bunch of assets like subprime mortgages that would never deserve a AAA rating, and you go to the rating agencies and you say, here is a fancy mathematical model, and when I brew all of them together and slice and dice them in some complicated way, a big chunk of them become AAA. And the rating agencies might look at it initially and say, well, I'm not sure it's AAA. Look, these assets are kind of dicey, but they're receiving very large fees, three times the fees that they would receive for a corporate bond rating. And there's a negotiation back and forth, and eventually the rating agencies agree. And they rated it. It's important to remember, there were only a handful of AAA-rated companies before this crisis, but the rating agencies rated thousands and thousands of these complicated instruments AAA. They really changed the meaning of AAA.
So isn't there an inherent conflict of interest here?
There's certainly an inherent conflict of interest, And I think that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the problems. And the extraordinary thing is that people are aware of this conflict and continue to rely on ratings. But I think one thing we should all do in aggregate is stop saying AAA. We wouldn't have to continue to rely on these rating agencies. We can find lots of substitutes in the market for saying AAA.
Alex Pollack, what would you say?
I would say that it's right that this problem is about structured securities, which are different from old traditional corporate ratings, although old corporate ratings are wrong from time to time as well. And that the, an obvious lesson from this, a little bit picking up on the question from your listener, to what did we learn, should we just stop this, is yes, we should stop having the government sponsor these ratings, let alone requiring people to use them since they have such obvious problems. Two other lessons are, when it comes to structured ratings, we could do better about defining what they mean, and secondly, they need to be updated much more frequently by the agencies.
Alex Pollack, he's resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and former president of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Chicago.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids and families succeed, at aecf.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The story of a boy who dreamed of bringing light to his village in Africa, how he taught himself physics and used spare parts to build a windmill that produced electricity. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Floyd Abrams is on the line with us, and I know you have to leave very soon. Here's an email for you, Floyd. It's from Jeff in Arlington, Virginia. He says, I lost nearly $10,000 in CDOs that were rated AAA, but it seems to me that Congress is going to gut the entire ratings industry if they let people sue the companies every time they disagree with a rating. I still want to be able to see bond ratings of a city, a company, etc. Shouldn't we focus our zest for reform on ratings of the complex structured assets that led to the problem in the first place?
Well, I think that's a very very serious and sober assessment of the situation. I think we should be focusing in part on the rating agencies, but in part on all the players in the process which led to the events, the unfortunate, unhappy, and for some devastating events of the past few years, and that we should, for example, you know, make it clear that the issuers of CDOs or other types of entities, you know, ought to have certain obligations, you know, serious legal obligations imposed on them to get out the whole story. That said, I think that your listener makes a, you know, a very, very strong point. I mean, we can go on trying to treat this as a matter of sort of retribution after the fact. There must be a way to punish the rating agencies, et cetera. Or we can, you know, try to find advances in the system. Advances, for example, by having more SEC oversight. Advances maybe of the sort that Mr. Pollack and Professor Portnoy favor, in terms of maybe getting rid of the whole NRSRO designation. The rating agencies never asked for those. You know, maybe it's a good idea to get rid of them entirely.
When you say they never asked for those, how did they come into that position?
Well, they came into it because there was a sense after certain market cracks and the like that there was the need for the government to step in and provide some sort of designations of entities which would serve as sort of checks. I mean, for example, in the great crack in the late 1980s, pension funds were investing their monies in entities that and funds which were very unsafe, and so Congress passed a law, and they said that, well, pension funds could only invest in entities that had an investment grade rating by an NRSRO. Now, the NRSROs, certainly my client, didn't ask for that. Congress thought in order to try to protect people who invested in pension funds, who were the recipients in the future of pension funds, that they should do something to try to put a buffer in the middle there. Now there's certainly a growing sense, and not just reflected on the people on this program, that maybe there shouldn't be, you know, any NRSRO status at all. Maybe the government should step back and stop designating one entity or another. And let me say that this is particularly a difficult area in a sense, because in the interest of more competition, the Congress passed legislation, which just took effect in 2007, making it much easier for other groups. There are now 10 NRSROs. There used to be 5, and effectively sometimes as little as few as 3. And there are going to be more and more. Well, as there are more and more, the SEC doesn't have power anymore to pass on whether these groups sort of are trained because we wanted more competition. I mean, that was a policy choice, a serious one, and I, for one, thought it was a good choice. But the more you expand the role of NRSROs, the more one asks the same questions that your other panelists are asking. Maybe we shouldn't have it at all.
Floyd Abrams, he's an attorney representing Standard & Poor's.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I was just, again, striking what Mr. Abrams said, which he seems to be going further than the SEC is willing to go, because it certainly is not changing that system. It has expanded the population, but nonetheless continues this phenomenon of the nationally anointed, the term is nationally recognized statistical rating organizations,
yes,
which is from a 1973 law. And again, it's kind of an ironic outcome of the Great Depression, because it was after that that the government first began saying to banks first and then to broker-dealers, look, you know, you can't invest in risky securities. And so, you know, we end up here.
All right. Let's take a caller in Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning. I was wondering, given all the First Amendment defenses isn't there some level of due diligence that was required either by the bond rating agency or by the company pooling these assets to just look at what they were buying and selling and rating?
Frank Partnoy.
There's only a very minimal level, and I think that's one of the reasons why people are so upset about the ratings, because these instruments could not have been sold without AAA ratings. We would not be here today if the credit rating agencies hadn't looked the other way and rated all of these complicated instruments AAA. And people are upset about it, but it's not, as Floyd Abrams suggested, it's not really about retribution. It's about moving to a more efficient and fair system. The government has become addicted to relying on these ratings. It's almost like a drug now that the government always looks to the rating agencies, and they continue to do this. Even in the recent reforms, the TALF, for example, looks to ratings. And it's not about retribution. It's about trying to create a fairer system going forward. And we know that the law has to be part of it. There has to be some kind of due diligence requirement, as your caller asks.
All right.
But that's got to come out of cases. You know, Oliver Wendell Holmes famously said, the law is a prediction of what a judge will do. And the prediction in the past had been judges will do nothing about these cases. Unfortunately, that's finally starting to change.
All right, let's go now to Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning to you.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I just wanted to state that defenders of this system, you know, similar to those defending the healthcare, what I call them the money handlers, who provide no service or benefits, whatever. And, you know, there's a story probably that the American people would benefit from knowing, you know, about the mass profits in the face of customers being kicked off their policies when they get ill. Points at the urgent necessity. I mean, this is really urgent, of legally and legislatively disbanding both the rating agencies and the healthcare money handler companies.
All right. Do you want to comment, Alex Pollack?
I just say, in the case of the rating agencies, if you have an investor who wants to buy the rating because he finds that the rating has value, then you have a market voluntary transaction. That's a good transaction. If you have investors who are forced to buy the ratings because the government requires them to buy it, then you have a non-voluntary transaction where the rating agency doesn't have to convince its customer that it's doing anything of value. It's just providing a kind of regulatory license. By the way, that's a point I learned from Frank Partnoy.
And Frank Partnoy, here's a tweet from Stephen, who says, is there any oversight on these credit rating agencies? What other organization can make money selling data without responsibility for any vetting?
I'm not sure there is one, and it's a great point. And let's just – it's extraordinary who you have on this program. And Alex and I and Michael, people are starting to – from very different political stripes are starting to agree on this issue. And there's a coalescence now of opinion. And we're seeing kind of a classic example of a couple of entrenched interests who have gotten these benefits of government regulation. The rating agencies are lobbying very hard against any kind of intrusion. And it's not just about – these government regulations that depend on ratings. It's about the oversight that came from that,
okay,
that tweet. It's about oversight as well, and they are making a First Amendment argument about oversight,
so,
too.
So, Frank Partnoy, if, as perhaps Alex Pollack would suggest, you do away with these ratings agencies, you do away with the government need for, requirement for these ratings agencies, then what does the investor count on?
The investor has to do its own due diligence.
That's what I thought.
And the investor can look to the market. There are things called credit default swaps that people talked about as being very dangerous, but they actually did a very good job of predicting some of the problems in the crisis. If investors had looked at credit default swaps of, for example, Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers, they would have seen major, major problems in the markets in 2007, 2 years ago. The rating agencies just kept the ratings at single A, single A, single A throughout the period up until very, very recently. So they shouldn't look to ratings. They should look to the markets. And markets are very valuable sources of information, but they also have to do their own due diligence.
Michael.
Well, another witness at the hearing yesterday, Lawrence White of New York University, had an interesting proposal, which is, eliminate the anointed special status of the big rating agencies, and force big investment managers at pension funds, insurance companies, all these institutions that are required to invest safely to actually do some work on their own, and the regulators as well, to be checking the investments, not without advice. I mean, you could have a whole population of rating agencies that act on a consulting basis. But, you know, what the phenomenon here is that a lot of these big investors became lazy, almost in the way that, you know, that a lot of these funds that were investing in Bernie Madoff's scheme were lazy. They didn't check. You know, they're not. And so what he's saying is, let's create a system where people are actually checking the things they're investing in.
But how many people have that kind of awareness, that kind of knowledge, that kind of institutional breadth to be able to do that, Alex Pollack?
The comments about what the due diligence required, of course, talking about institutional investors, so large organizations. And in the case of the structured mortgage securities, those institutions often built their own models, or they replicated, they reverse engineered the ratings models. And there, I think, one of the most important things, coming back to this point of definition, is what does that rating mean? For example, what kind of house price decline can this rating stand? It could be disclosed. This is a triple A, which is going to pay, provided house prices don't fall less than 0%, let's say. A notable exchange happened a few years ago when an analyst asked a rating agency, what happens to your model if house prices go down 3%? And the guy says, my model blows up.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Woodhull, Massachusetts. Good morning, Dan. You're on the air.
Good morning. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
Yes, and it's an interesting show. I've got a question on, I agree that we should look towards reform and not as much on retribution, but on the idea that these firms cannot be held liable because their predictions for the ratings were basically predictions, aren't the predictions created from current or past data in these, what you're calling, complicated systems? Isn't there a record of these, of this data, and can't that be looked at and then have them held accountable or liable because of how they created these predictions?
Frank Partnoy.
Yes, that's absolutely right, and that's what's happening in many of these cases. And that's what the whistleblowers were talking about yesterday. They were talking about the data and the models that are being used, yes, to make predictions, but they're being used now. They're being used today, and the assumptions that go into those models are unreasonable.
And they're still being used today, even after this kind of crash.
I think they are. I think that's what part of the testimony was from yesterday, that the same system is still being used. The rating agencies are still using the same models. Wall Street is continuing to structure these products. People are still making money. And the extraordinary thing is that because the government has basically forced people to look to ratings, investors are continuing to buy these products.
All right. So, Frank Partnoy, if you were an ordinary investor, I'm not talking about huge. I'm talking about, say, a $20,000 bond. What would you be looking at as a guide?
I think the main thing to do is to stay with simplicity. If you're an average investor, not to get into something complicated in the structured finance area, it's just not worth it.
But how do you know if it's complicated?
Well, if it's a company that you've heard of, okay, if it's ExxonMobil, it has a high rating because it's a creditworthy company, you can buy those bonds, and the credit ratings historically have been much more accurate. So if you must look to credit ratings, look to industrial companies' credit ratings rather than structured finance. So it should be a name that you recognize. It shouldn't be something like the witnesses were talking about yesterday, like Nine Grade Funding 2 or Sahara Finance Europe Limited. If you see that, if you see CDO of ABS, you want to run screaming.
Alex?
Frank is absolutely right. A retail investor should never be buying structured securities, period. Now, there is a little trick in here that those same retail investors are beneficial owners of institutional funds like mutual funds and pension funds. And they have to look to the due diligence done by the managers of those funds, but they can't do it themselves.
And
this is a really important point, and people have their money in pension funds and money market funds, and those funds might be invested in this complicated stuff without your knowledge.
Frank Partnoy, he's law and finance professor at the University of San Diego. He's author of The Match King. Michael Hirsch is senior editor and national economics correspondent at Newsweek, author of At War with Ourselves, and Alex Pollack. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you all so much.
Thank you,
Diane.
I'll be off for the next few days, going to Philadelphia for a voice treatment. Hope to be back with you early next week. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.